The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Beautiful day here at Edstone, mid-40s, so a little bit chilly, but bright and sunny day here in the West Midlands. This morning, we welcome two new students from our headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma. They arrived, as it happens, while I was trying to finish up with my doctrines class, so that was a little bit distracting, hearing my wife outside squealing along with the newbies. But we got through it, and we were able to spend a little bit of time with them after the class ended. We also have one of Ed Stone's own, Isaac McDonald. He's dancing today, even in, I think, the next 30 minutes or so. He's at the All-Ireland's Championship over in Killarney, Ireland's, the southwestern tip of Ireland. So hopefully he's dancing his heart out there in that that major competition. Also back in the States, my father had his first night of the Houston campaign last evening. I didn't get an email update on that. Hopefully we'll have some additional information on that tomorrow on the program. But you'll recall that he was in Los Angeles January 21 and 22, and we had 230 people the first night there, and then 175 the second night, and we're really encouraged by just how receptive the audience was. In fact, my father goes into that in his latest coworker letter, and we just provided some proofreading for that over the weekend, and hopefully that letter will go out here in the next day or two. And he talks in that coworker letter, by the way, about his campaign this weekend in Houston. And there's more trips ahead for him. He's heading down to Australia and the Philippines at the end of March and early April. So hopefully following that, there will be some more campaigns to report on as we carry on with this year. Later on today's show, we'll get into a Bible study that I kept pushing back last week on overcoming the way that Jesus Christ overcame the devil. There's a verse over in Revelation 3 that talks about overcoming just like Christ overcame, and then sitting down with Christ on his throne, even as Christ rules from the Father's throne or sits with the Father on his throne. Pretty amazing verse. What was it? What was it that Jesus Christ did? I mean, what was it primarily that empowered him or allowed for him, enabled him to overcome the power of the devil? We'll get into that, as I say, coming up in on this show. Well, if you saw the headlines over the weekend, you might have thought that Israel launched a preemptive strike on an Iranian target in Syria. The Guardian, for example, said that Israel launched a large-scale air raid in Syria after one of its F-16 fighters crashed while under Syrian anti-aircraft fire. That's how it was reported here in the UK. The New York Times headline over the weekend said, Israel strikes Iran in Syria and loses a jet. Now, you dig into these articles a little bit, three, four, five paragraphs in, and then you start to get some more critical details, crucial details to this story, because Israel was actually retaliating against an Iranian attack on Israeli airspace. It happened on Saturday. An advanced model Iranian drone entering into Israeli airspace. And I think it was there for some 90 seconds before an IDF attack helicopter was able to shoot it down. And then from there, Israel launched an airstrike against the drone command center, and that was situated in Syria. And in the process of that attack, one of the Israeli F-16 fighter jets was shot down, as I mentioned. And then following that, Israel then widened its offensive in going after, I think it was 10 or 12 targets these anti-aircraft targets there in southern Syria. These installations, these Iranian installations, basically, right in the, right in southern Syria, not far from the Golan Heights. So this was a large-scale clash, for sure. It was a big deal. There's no doubting that. But again, just looking at how this kind of thing is covered here in the UK, in the US media, it's as if Israel's always the aggressor. In fact, like Melanie Phillips says in her column today, Israel's the sitting duck. Israel's just sitting there, and of course you have all of these attacks, sometimes from Hezbollah, sometimes from Hamas, in this case, directly from Iran, coming from Syria. I'll come to Melanie Phillips' piece here in just a second. First, though, let me direct your attention to Yakov Katz. He wrote this in the Jerusalem Post on Sunday. He said, "The open war with Iran has begun." That's the headline. And then he writes, "The shadow war between Israel and Iran has been going on for years, bringing us closer and closer to today's events and what is to come." He says, "What happened in northern Israel on Saturday is the beginning of the overt and direct war between Israel and Iran. The infiltration and interception of an Iranian drone over Israel, the downing of an Israeli F-16, and Israel's retaliatory strikes against Syrian and Iranian targets that followed are apparently just the opening scenes of a potentially wider conflict that could erupt if Iran continues trying to fortify its presence in the new Syria. This is the new reality in the Middle East. Iran building this land bridge, as we've been covering, all the way through to the Mediterranean, and now all of these installations in Syria. Now that the U.S. is gone, now that the dust has settled, oh, ISIS has been destroyed. And here is Iran again spreading its influence and power throughout the region and now pushing right up to the border of Israel. And as Yakov Katz brings out at the Post, I mean, this was long in the making. You could see it building to this point years ago if you had eyes to see, if you were watching world events, if you were reading thetrumpet.com. And yet not many people do that. Not enough. Not nearly enough. I mean, even the clash over the weekend. I saw the headlines and thought, well, my first thought was to dismiss it that, well, Israel went in on a preemptive strike because there was a dangerous installation somewhere. In fact, it was a clash and one retaliatory act after another. And you watch by today. It's a good thing, at least in the States, you get this program first, 7 in the morning in Oklahoma. Because how much coverage do you... It's already old news. It happened on Saturday. Israel was the aggressor. They're to blame. The New York Times is done with it. And we move on to the latest Trump scandal. It's so predictable. And yet Jesus tells us we better watch world events, particularly in the Middle East. We better watch Jerusalem. We better watch the little nation of Israel. And the king of the south, that's Iran. What do the prophecies say? Look at all that's happened in Syria over the last several years. And now the dust has settled. And so what are we left with? Well, Anthony Chibadiwe, he had an article at the Trumpet just last week about Iran's expanding presence and power all the way through to the Mediterranean. And with respect to Syria, he said Iran controls 82,000 troops in Syria and has spent $35 billion on weapons factories in Syria. Where are they getting all these tens of billions of dollars? Well, from the United States, thanks to President Obama, former President Obama. And the worst foreign policy decision or agreement in America's history, as my father has said. Anthony said in his piece last week, this was at thetrumpet.com, that they're building all of these installations in the south of Syria. right in the midst of all of these heavy population centers. Why? Well, Hezbollah and Hamas could tell them that this is the way that you do it. This is the safest way to go. Human shields. Put all the civilians around this anti-aircraft missile installation, and you'll be just fine. And then if Israel strikes back, if Israel retaliates, then the big story will be that civilians died. Israel used disproportionate force. And if Iran instigated it, we'll just pass over that. In the headline, we'll say Israel did this. Israel strikes Iran and Syria. It was Iran that lashed out at Israel over the weekend. Melanie Phillips, she says the immediate support shown to Israel by the U.S., which declared robustly that Israel had every right to defend itself, was obviously welcome. Nevertheless, there is surely something very wrong about this situation, which everyone, including the U.S., appears to accept as normal. See, the only nation in that region whose behavior is carefully monitored and scrutinized by the international news media is Israel. Iran, well, they send a drone, or they fire missiles, or they use their proxies. That doesn't really need a headline. That's just what they do, okay? We've accepted that. That's the new normal. Melanie Phillips says here, Iran is a fanatical Islamic regime driven by a genocidal aim of exterminating Israel. I mean, does that not count for something? Could that not get a headline or two? It says it has repeatedly announced this to the world. There can be no doubt about its implacable intention to realize this infernal goal. It says, in Lebanon, its proxy army, Hezbollah, has embedded within the civilian population upwards of 150,000 missiles pointing at Israel. In Syria, Iran's support of Assad has enabled it to reach Israel's border. In Gaza, Iran is embedding itself through Hamas. All of these regions border Israel. Did you know that? Israel, in other words, is surrounded by Iran and its proxies. Say for Little Jordan, you've got Syria to the north, around the Golan Heights, Hezbollah a little further north, just on the other side of the border, pointing missiles at Haifa. And then you've got Gaza down south, Hamas, aiming its missiles at Sderot and all the other southern cities. The last time they fired longer-range missiles, they reached the suburbs of Tel Aviv. Even the suburb of Jerusalem. We were there when that happened in 2012. Surrounded. Melanie Phillips says here, since the debacle of the 2003 war in Iraq, who else has written about the debacle in 2003? Remember when the U.S. troops were sweeping across the region, toppling Saddam Hussein's regime? Flexing its military might, its muscle. Now you look at it 15 years on, and, well, can you call it a victory for the U.S.? Since the debacle of the 2003 war in Iraq, launched with the aim of preventing Saddam Hussein from obtaining or developing weapons of mass destruction, the West appears to have decided that preemptive strikes are off the table forever. Well, we had a preemptive strike in Iraq, in Afghanistan. Well, really, that wasn't even preemptive, was it? Because that was following 9/11. So really, this sitting duck mentality, it goes back decades. She says this means Israel has to act like a sitting duck, waiting for Iran to attack it before it can do anything to defend itself. Even the drone is being said in some quarters not to have represented a real attack. I mean, it's just a drone. It's not really an attack. In other words, Israel has to wait for its citizens to be killed. How many? It has to wait for its citizens to be killed before it is entitled to take any military action. And even then, what's the betting it would still be presented as the aggressor? She's spot on with this. Look at the coverage from the weekend. It's just a drone. Or if Hamas fires missiles, well, they're little rockets there, and they don't really have that good of aim. So just let them do it. Just let them launch missiles into Jewish communities. We'll give that a pass. She talks in her piece about the recent movie, Darkest Hour, about how, I mean, it has a few flaws, that movie, but for the most part, as Melanie Phillips brings out, it's bringing to our attention some history that, as she says, most people don't even know. The fact that Hitler could have been stopped years earlier and that tens of millions of lives could have been saved if the West had the courage to conduct a few more preemptive strikes. As it is, we just cleared the way. And Hitler just rampaged his way through Europe. She says, Israel's position today is analogous to Hitler having positioned 150,000 missile batteries in, say, Ireland, all pointing at Britain, and then advancing into France and reaching the Normandy coast, all the while steadily embedding his forces in the Channel Islands. That's what's happening in Israel, or around Israel. That would be the equivalent if this little island nation, what once was Great Britain, surrounded by forces, 150,000 strong in Ireland, pushing up to Normandy in northern France. Well, she says here, Britain finally went to war when Hitler invaded Poland. Even in appeasement, Britain, no one suggested it should have waited until the Nazis reached the French coast before it decided to fight them. Had it done so, Britain, along with Europe, would now be a Nazi dictatorship. Or had it not done so. Yet people expect Israel to sit on its hands, while genocidal fanatics, intent on its destruction, encircle it unimpeded. Do we see what's happening? Now, it's not going to lead to this all-out war between Israel and Iran. That's not to say Israel might not strike or preemptively strike somewhere. That really hasn't been the history, though. But we know that ultimately this is leading to Europe getting more involved and the clash between the King of the North and the King of the South, as Daniel 11 prophesies. But certainly, what we saw this weekend just takes us a step closer to these prophecies being fulfilled in a spectacular way. Well, Melanie Phillips says here, no civilized country wants war, and Israel will do everything it can to avoid an all-out conflict. But Iran is already at war with Israel, a war Iran has initiated. How many people even recognize this fact? They're already at war. She says the question today is whether the strength and accuracy of Israel's response to the drone will deter Iran from further aggression. That's the one question now. Israel's not going to carry on with this. But now we wait. How will Iran respond to this? She says there will be a far greater chance of averting all-out war if Britain and Europe finally come to their senses and start holding Iran's feet to the fire rather than seeking to sanitize, excuse, and reward it at every opportunity. Well, she's on to something there, because eventually, not so much Britain, but Europe will finally come to its senses. Europe will finally act. Let me just give you her conclusion. These nations may afford themselves the luxury of setting the value of Jewish lives at zero, but the state of Israel was founded on the principle, never again. And if it needs be, it will also say, just as the defiant British soldier declared in the famous David Lowe cartoon in the darkest hour, very well alone. If Israel acts, she says, well, Israel's going to have to act alone. So here is this open clash now between Israel and Iran. And Israel's desperate for allies. Israel doesn't want to act alone. And right now, of course, in looking at it, particularly with what's happened over the last month or two, with President Trump recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and promising to move the embassy there. Mike Pence, of course, had his visit just a couple of weeks ago. And so it would seem like that U.S.-Israeli alliance is as strong as ever. But given what the prophet Hosea says, and given the absence of the United States and Britain in that clash, that prophesied clash in Daniel 11, there's going to be some dramatic shifts in alliances here real soon. Daniel Pipes last week, he's a Middle East expert, writes on the, I mean, he says in his article, look, I've been wrong about the Trump administration before, and hopefully I am this time, but I don't think we need to get too excited here about the Trump administration's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital, because in giving that, and it is a big perk to Israel. What is Israel going to have to sacrifice once the Palestinians do finally return to the so-called negotiating table? Daniel Pipes said this last week. For example, members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation overwhelmingly condemned his step, as did members of both the UN Security Council and the General Assembly. That's talking about the decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem. In addition, recognition caused Palestinian violence against Israelis to triple. Thus, Mr. Trump made Jerusalem a more disputed issue than it had been previously. So really, the dispute, the division, the strife, the violence is just intensifying. And Daniel Pipes' prediction is with a frustration and fury that could sour him on the Jerusalem recognition and on Israel. It could even prompt this temperamental and spontaneous figure to rescind the recognition. I mean, you're not seeing too many people making that prediction, saying that the Trump administration might rescind on that decision. But we know that the relationship in the end is not going to be good. Isaiah chapter 9, I think it's the last verse in that passage, talks about these brother nations fighting against one another, and Ephraim and Manasseh going against Israel, or little Judah. Pipes goes on to talk about what Israel may have to pay in terms of the price for Jerusalem. He says, Mr. Trump intends to exact an unspecified price from Israel for the recognition, stating Israel will pay for that, and it would have had to pay more. For the moment, with the Palestinian Authority boycotting American mediation and personally insulting Mr. Trump, that price is abeyance or inactivity. That's all Israel has to do right now. But it says the American door is permanently open to Palestinians, and when they wise up, some fabulous gift awaits them in the White House. I mean, when they wise up and they come back to the negotiating table, you can expect the United States, as it's been doing in recent years, to apply a lot of pressure on Israel. Pipes even talks about the U.S. decision to withhold the $65 million in funding from UNRWA because of, well, if the Palestinians aren't coming to the negotiating table, then why should we pay all this money? In other words, it's not so much to punish the UN or to punish the PA. The money's withheld because the Palestinians aren't negotiating. And so this could all change very quickly. This could change in a hurry if, as he brings out in his piece, the Palestinians wise up to what's happening and return to the negotiating table, which, if recent history informs them, they're going to know that they can expect the United States negotiators to press Israel for making concessions. That's been the peace process. That's the deadly wound that Hosea prophesied of. Pipe says here, so once the PA leader, Mahmoud Abbas, gets over his extended snit about Jerusalem and agrees to talk peace, he has a bevy of benefits awaiting him. The possible reversal of the Jerusalem recognition, some fabulous reward, and the resumption of full, maybe even expanded U.S. funding. At that point, the Pope, the Chancellor, the Crown Prince, and the New York Times will congratulate a glowing Trump, and Israel will find itself coldly thrust out of favor. Well, some of this is speculative, but since we know that the U.S. is not even mentioned in Daniel 11 and verse 40, and since we know that Judah, upon seeing its gaping flesh wound, turns to the Assyrians, that's what Hosea prophesies, we've got to keep our eyes right on this. Daniel Pipes says here, finally, when that happens, well, let me just back up. So after a decent interval, Mr. Abbas inexorably will mumble apologies, lavish praise on Mr. Trump, fire up the Palestinians' horde of proxies, talk peace with Israel, and worm his way into the administration's good graces. When that happens, the current U.S.-Israel honeymoon will likely crash and burn, replaced by the usual bickering where Americans want Israelis to, quote, take chances for peace, unquote, and to, quote, make painful concessions, unquote. And they resist those pressures. He goes on to say, look, I've been wrong before on Mr. Trump, and I hope I am this time around as well. But you put that analysis together with, well, even over the weekend, there was an interview. There's no audio sound bites for this, but President Trump made some comments in an interview with Israel Hayom. This is a news publication in Israel that asked the president, this is just from yesterday, will Israel have to give something in return for the decision on Jerusalem? He says, I think both sides will have to make hard compromises to reach a peace agreement. So here again, just because the Palestinians have said that's enough, we don't want to have anything to do with Trump or the United States. We want Europe. Just because they're saying that, we shouldn't interpret that to mean that, well, the alliance with the U.S. and Israel is as strong as ever. Hayom asked President Trump, obviously there is suspense in Israel about the imminent peace plan. When will the U.S. unveil its peace plan? And the president answered this way, we're going to see what goes on. Right now, I would say the Palestinians are not looking to make peace. They're not looking to make peace. And I'm not necessarily sure that Israel is looking to make peace either. That's quite a statement. And then he went on to say, we'll see what happens. Finally, Israel Hayom says, will settlements be part of the plan? President Trump said, we'll be talking about settlements. The settlements are something that very much complicates and always have complicated making peace. So I think Israel has to be very careful with the settlements. So as I say, Daniel Pipes, his forecast, I don't think it's off the wall. What he was saying. I mean, even if you follow that was President Trump himself. If you find some of the statements that his Middle East envoy has said, Jason Greenblatt, I mean, he's even come out stronger in favor of the Palestinians and critical of Israel. Talking about even if the Palestinians show up, that they could revisit that decision to withhold the 65 million. This is from Al Monitor, the Lebanese publication. It says the initiative, it says in parallel, the EU plans to approach Washington with a new initiative that could generate the opening of partial negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians with the backing of the international community. I mean, that's really what we want to watch for here, is Europe getting more involved. And that's what everyone's discussing. I mean, even the apparent strong alliance between the U.S. And Israel. I mean, that's offending Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinians to the point where they don't want the U.S. to be involved. Right now, Israel sees the United States as an ally, But how much longer will it last? How much longer before Hosea 5, as it says, how much longer before they turn to the Assyrians? We've got to watch Jerusalem. He says, finally, this is from Al Monitor, also the negotiations would deal with the transfer of Palestinian neighborhoods in the East Jerusalem area outside the Old City from Israeli jurisdiction to Palestinian jurisdiction as Area B. It says the EU will also propose, these are all, again, proposals from the EU. They'll propose an international East Jerusalem neighborhood development plan. Of course, there's plenty of nations in Europe and, of course, the Vatican, too, that have long wanted for Israel to be an international city. Well, I've gone a little over time with this, but I'll just refer you to Callum Wood's piece from February 2nd. This is just a week and a half ago. Can Europe broker peace in the Middle East? Watch Europe. Watch Europe. Mahmoud Abbas is calling on Europe or the EU as its true partner and friend to get involved and to help solve the problems of the Middle East or to help reignite the so-called peace process. That, as I say, is at thetrumpet.com. And there's some other things here as well. But as for those scriptures, again, Hosea 5, verse 13, of course, Zechariah 14, 1 and 2, we know that there's going to be a clash between the Palestinians and the Israelis over the city of Jerusalem. And then, of course, much bigger than that, there's the clash in Daniel 11 and verse 40. Verse 40 and verse 41, about the king of the north coming into the glorious land, as it says there, evidently by a peaceful entry. And then, of course, it acts as the trigger that sets off World War III. A lot to keep our eyes on, for sure. My father said back in 1996, Europe is moving not only to be a co-sponsor in the peace process, they want to gain control. There's lots of talk now, right now in the news, about Europe co-sponsoring the peace process along with the U.S., But as my father said way back in 96, this is over 20 years ago, they not only want to be the co-sponsor, they want to gain control of it. That's what's prophesied. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to contact us, to email us any feedback, you can send messages to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Jerusalem. The name means City of Peace, and yet no city has had a history filled with more war and bloodshed. No city has suffered like Jerusalem. It has been the focal point of religious wars throughout the centuries. Jerusalem plays a central role in the beliefs of three major religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. To the Arabs and Jews, Jerusalem is a national symbol. While both sides have attempted to form peace treaties, Jerusalem continually remains the center of dispute. Why all this conflict surrounding Jerusalem? Will the Israeli-Palestinian peace process put an end to the chaos? Will there ever be peace in Jerusalem? The Holy Bible provides the answers concerning the future of this great city. Your Bible states that the tensions revolving around Jerusalem are only going to worsen before they get better. This city will be engaged in some of the worst violence ever to occur in the history of man. But there is great hope for Jerusalem. At the conclusion of these painful events, Jerusalem will experience glory and magnificence as no city ever has, and there will finally be peace in Jerusalem. To understand the important role Jerusalem will play in future events, visit our literature library on thetrumpet.com and request our free booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy.
The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Notice verse 21 of Revelation 3. To him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame and am set down with my Father in his throne. We have to overcome the way Christ overcame. In Matthew 4, he had a titanic struggle with Satan, the devil, and he overcame the devil. And he says, now you have to overcome as I overcame.
We have to overcome the way that Jesus Christ overcame the devil. That's from my father's program last year, The Mystery of Civilization. He's talking there, of course, about Revelation 3, verse 21 in particular. To him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me in my throne, even as I also overcame, and am set down with my Father in his throne. How come you don't hear verses like this read in Protestant denominations or in traditional Christianity in general? I mean, if you back up to Revelation 2, there at the end of that chapter, it talks about the saints of God being given power over the nations. The overcomers. They're given power to rule with a rod of iron. We overcome how? The way that Jesus did. How did Jesus do it? How did he overcome sin? He was tempted in all points, just like we are. Hebrews 4:15 says that. And yet he didn't sin. He conquered sin. He conquered the devil. You can read about the titanic confrontation in Matthew 4. My father alluded to it in that clip I just played for you. Let me just play you a clip from Herbert Armstrong. This goes back to one of his messages on the subject of why we're here. Here's clip 2.
Then, beginning verse 1, then was Jesus led up of the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, you ever fast 40 days and 40 nights? No water, no food. But anyway, he was very, very hungry at that time and very, very weak physically. And when the tempter or Satan came to him, he said, if thou be the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. He put that big if. He appealed to his vanity. Anyone of vanity who said, oh, I'll show you whether I'm the Son of God or not. But Jesus wasn't filled with that kind of vanity. He was filled with humility and obedience to God. Humility and obedience to God.
He was filled with humility and obedience to God. He didn't have vanity. So he just answered the devil right out of God's word. That's how he responded in that exchange throughout Matthew 4. Read it. Read it on your own. My father wrote in the Key of David booklet, he said, we must conquer Satan as Christ did. When we do, we become God's precious royalty. This fact should be the inspiration and motivation behind our spiritual lives. What an inspiration that should be. I mean, the fact that we're going to be on Jesus Christ's throne. That's what God says to the saints. I just read it to you. It's just right out of the Bible. This shouldn't sound strange. Ruling with Jesus Christ on his throne, if we overcome, as he overcame, if we have that kind of Christ-like humility that Mr. Armstrong mentioned there, that's how he did it. Christ humbled himself, even unto death, even to go through excruciating pain and suffering. He humbled himself. 1 Peter 5 has a fair bit to say about this Christ-like humility. It says in verse 5, likewise, this is 1 Peter 5, likewise, you younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. Yes, all of you, be subject one to another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. I mean, here it says, submit yourselves one to another. You younger, submit to the elder. And all of us, be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud and he gives grace to the humble, how much, or rather, how does your humble clothing look? Clothed with humility, getting up each day, and of course, putting it on like we would our physical clothing. But then it doesn't even come from anything that we have stored in the closet. It comes from God. It comes from God through His Spirit. Humble yourselves, verse 6, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time. God's mighty hand, I mean, He made the universe. We're just a speck of dirt comparatively, not even that. And God says, if you humble yourself before His mighty hand, then I'll exalt you. Read Isaiah 66, verses 1 and 2, if you want to continue this study. You've got some other passages that I won't take the time to go through, like Matthew 4. I mean, before that titanic confrontation, what did Jesus Christ do? He fasted for 40 days and for 40 nights. That was humbling. That was humbling. He humbled himself before the mighty hand of God, and then when Satan approached, he had the mighty hand of God to back him and to empower him. It says in verse 7, staying here in 1 Peter 5, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. See, we're all targets. God's people, God's family in particular, massive targets in the eyes of the devil. And he's seeking whom he can devour. And to avoid being devoured, whether you're a minister or a member, a father, a mother, a youth in God's church, the key is to be on guard, to be vigilant, and to humble ourselves before the mighty hand of God. That takes a constant, continual, vigilant effort. That means never letting down. That means never letting down on our prayer and Bible study. I mean, if the old correspondence course brings out that if you didn't have to put forth intense effort to put on this kind of humility, to put on the armor of God, as it says in Ephesians 6. I mean, how could we ever be considered an overcomer? We have to overcome the way that Jesus Christ did. So it does require intense effort on our part, steadfast vigilance on our part. Of course, together with the power of God's Spirit. Verse 9 says, whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. Resist, you see, be steadfast in the faith. Sure, there's afflictions, there's trials and tests, but they're not unusual, they're not unique to us, to you or to me. All of God's people, all of God's family have to resist against our adversary, have to submit to the mighty hand of God, or to humble ourselves before the mighty hand of God. Otherwise, we leave ourselves wide open for an attack. You look at some of those nature programs, and the king of the jungle, the lion, that goes after the weakling from the flock. He zeroes in on the one that is easiest to overpower. And so we can't afford to let down or to get complacent or to be spiritually inactive. This is Satan's world. You could say that this is his home turf. Revelation 12 and verse 12, he's been cast down to this earth. He's deceived the whole world. He's now confined to this earth along with his demons. And we're here too. And if we get careless, or if we get lazy, or if we get overconfident, or if we get self-reliant, we will be devoured, and it can happen so suddenly. That's true. Let's look over at Proverbs 3. Here again, just to dwell on this point about the attitude of a true Christian, the humbleness of mind. Humble yourselves before the mighty hand of God, and let God exalt you. Let God empower you. Let God provide the strength. This is Proverbs 3 and verse 1. It says, my son, forget not my law, but let thine heart keep my commandments. For length of days and long life and peace shall they add unto you. If we keep God's law, we're going to have blessings. We're going to be strong, like it says in Deuteronomy 8, I believe. We'll have a long life. And peace will just naturally ensue. It says in verse 3, let not mercy and truth forsake you. Bind them about your neck. Write them upon the table of your heart. So shall you find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man, it says in verse 4. And then verse 5, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. Don't even lean in that direction. Put your faith and your trust wholeheartedly in God, in His ways, in His truth. Don't rely on self. We really, I mean, we're born with minds that are just half there. The book of Genesis, the opening chapters, bring this out. God offered the Holy Spirit to our first parents through the tree of life, but they rejected that tree, and God cut them off. And so mankind has been operating ever since with half a mind. It's not even really accurate to say it's half, because as 1 Corinthians 2 brings out, when you look at the carnal mind apart from God and His Spirit and compare it to God's mind, it's like comparing the mind of a giraffe to the mind of a human. What a difference the ability that human beings have to think and to reason, to create, to appreciate fine culture. Well, the disparity is just as wide or great when you compare the difference between the human mind and the mind of God. Humble ourselves. Humble yourself before the mighty hand of God. That's what it takes to let the mind of God in. Let this mind be in you, Philippians 2:5. Let the mind of Christ be in you. Well, carrying on in Proverbs here, it says in verse 6, in all your ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord, and depart from evil. See, in all of your ways, acknowledge God. Let Him direct your paths. Fear God. Depart from evil. Don't be wise in your own eyes. Don't be lifted up with pride and vanity. Don't exalt yourself. Humble yourself, it says, before the mighty hand of God. And let God take care of the exalting. I mean, and when you talk about being exalted right up to the throne of Jesus Christ, if we overcome as Jesus Christ overcame, you mean we're going to be on the throne with Jesus Christ? That's what your Bible says. Let me take you over to the book of Jeremiah. Just a few more verses here before we conclude. Jeremiah 17, firstly. Let's just begin here, and then we can finish up over in chapter 10. But in Jeremiah 17 and verse 9, it says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I mean, look at how deceitful the human heart is. There's a verse in James 1 that says if we know to do right or to obey this and we don't do it, then we're deceiving ourselves. And we can justify our acts or our behavior any way that we want. But the self-deception hanging over the typical individual like this dark cloud, how easy it is to be desperately wicked. Or dangerously sick, as it says in that verse. That's the meaning. to have this incurable sickness, this wound, spiritually speaking. How does it happen? Well, Jeremiah 17 and verse 5, just backing up a few verses, it says, "Thus says the Eternal, cursed be the man that trusts in man and makes flesh his arm or his strength, and whose heart departs from the Eternal." We come under a curse when we don't trust God. When we put our faith or our trust in some other human being or even in ourselves. Cursed be the man, it says, who relies on human flesh or strength rather than the power of the mighty hand of God. Here again, just to paraphrase what it says there in 1 Peter 5. Look now at chapter 10. It's a great passage here. Chapter 10. Jeremiah 10 and verse, we'll start in verse 21. Let me just read to you what my father says, though, in the Jeremiah booklet. It says, "That man," this is talking about what we just read in Jeremiah 17, "that man they trust may be a leader, or it may even be their own human nature. People can follow their own minds." He goes on to talk about, this is in the Jeremiah booklet, about how that this is the fundamental lesson that man hasn't learned for 6,000 years, that we're cursed if we follow a man. Now, God does work through men, and God wants you to find out where his servant is on this earth. You've got some proving to do if you don't know that yet. But then, like Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11, we follow that man as he follows Christ. And if he doesn't follow Christ, we don't follow the man. God says if you just blindly follow the man wherever he goes, you're under a curse. We have to look for Christ. We have to follow Jesus Christ's lead. Jeremiah 10 here, and verse 21, it says, "For the pastors are become brutish and have not sought the Eternal. Therefore they shall not prosper, and all their flocks shall be scattered." This is human leadership. This is carnal leadership. Brutish pastors, they haven't fed the flock. They haven't pointed the brethren to the mighty hand of God. Verse 22 says, "Behold, the noise of the brute is come, and a great commotion out of the north country to make the cities of Judah desolate in a den of dragons." I mean, that's what's coming upon our nations, upon little Judah, upon Ephraim and Manasseh. This is what God has to do to wake us up. To get our attention, to get us to a point where we'll put our faith and our trust in God. And the prophet here says in verse 23, "O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself." It's not in man that walks to direct his steps. See, if we really understand this, if we really accept this truth, aren't we going to be motivated to go to God and to ask for correction? To ask for him to guide our steps? To ask for him to reveal his will and to give us the discernment and the understanding and the faith? To follow him? Pray for God daily to correct you with love, with mercy, of course. But to correct us so that we don't have to go through what he describes in verses 21 and 22. To receive that daily instruction, that daily correction, so that God might then exalt us in due time. That's what Jeremiah the prophet did. Verse 24 says, "O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing, but correct me because I need it." It's not in man that walks to direct his own steps. We just don't know. That's why we need God in our lives. We're coming up to the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread season on the calendar year, end of March, early April. And God wants for us certainly to put our focus on the sacrifice, the tremendous sacrifice of Jesus Christ. The 1 Corinthians 11 and 2 Corinthians 13 also talk about examining ourselves to make sure we're living in the faith, to make sure we're meeting up to the test, that we're passing with high marks. It takes some humility. It takes this kind of humbleness of mind to really get those high marks that we're seeking. Humble yourselves before the mighty hand of God. This is what Jesus did in the lead up to that titanic confrontation in Matthew 4. He fasted and prayed, humbled himself for 40 days and for 40 nights. And because of that, and just the way that he lived his entire life, that same way, he overcame the devil. He overcame the devil. He conquered the devil. He conquered the devil's influence. And that's why God highly exalted him. And soon he's to reign over all the earth as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.